Hello, and welcome to Jazz Vignettes from the Hall. I am Maria Leniak. In this special series, music enthusiast Steve Gedrose explores the world of jazz from its roots to the present day. He breaks the fascinating, ever-evolving genre of jazz into easy, digestible themes, backed up, of course, with plenty of music examples. In each episode, Steve will introduce you to musicians who were, or are, some of the key driving forces behind the evolution of jazz music. We recorded Steve's presentations live at the beautiful Old Fire Hall in downtown Whitehorse, Yukon. Annually, between October and April, Jazz Yukon presents 5 concerts as part of their Jazz in the Hall concert series. These events feature leading local jazz groups and are opened with a presentation by Steve, where he provides the background and interesting tidbits about the live music performed that evening. In episode 37, Steve presents a short introduction to the interesting history of the piano's invention and development. From there, we explore music by several heroes of piano jazz. We will hear select pieces by Jelly Roll Morton, Art Tatum, Thelonious Monk, and Bill Evans. All of these players were well aware of the history of the music and put their unique stamp on their recordings. It's remarkable that both piano jazz and recording technology have evolved in tandem over a period of about 50 years. The piano has proven integral to jazz and will remain a vital component of many ensembles into the future. To tell you more, here is Steve Gedrose.
Well, I just thought I'd trot out some of the jazz shows that I've done for CBC over the years, and it seemed appropriate to talk about piano jazz tonight. And first, I thought I'd just talk a little bit about the history of the piano. In the Baroque era, we have an instrument called the harpsichord, which is a keyboard with the strings similar to a piano. The difference is that the notes are plucked, so as you're playing the harpsichord, there are absolutely no dynamics on that instrument whatsoever. In other words, you can't make it softer, you can't make it louder. Every time you hit the key, the note is the same volume. So what they do in Baroque music is just ornament that endlessly to add some variation. So the idea was to make a louder instrument. So first thing was developed was the pianoforte, which means soft, loud. That just gave more dynamics. So this was kind of the precursor to the modern piano. The piano was invented around 1700. It's a little vague when it actually came, but this was by Bartolomeo Cristofori. He worked for the Medici family in Florence. He was a harpsichord maker. It was an attempt to combine loudness with control of the volume. So we have the modern day piano, or starting to be the modern day piano. There was still some improvements to be made. And one of the main ones was by a guy called Gottfried Silbermann. He was a German maker. He invented the damper pedal, which allowed you to dampen the strings and let that off so you could change the volume. Now, he was around in J.S. Bach's time, who was quite a keyboard player, as we know. Bach tried out one of the original instruments of Silbermann, and he didn't like it because the high notes were too soft. They didn't have the full dynamic range that he was looking for. So Silbermann was not pleased, but that was the word from the man. So he went back and improved that, and I find this quite amusing. Bach liked the new version and actually became a salesman for these pianos. So I can't imagine buying a piano from a guy who virtually mastered the keyboard repertoire. So one of the major technical innovations in the piano was the strong iron frame. This is called the plate. This allowed more tension on the strings, so they could use heavier gauge wire. They could use more strings to increase the volume, to keep up with all the other instruments in the orchestra, because, of course, this is long, long before amplification. So this was all happening in the early 1800s. In 1825, the first single cast iron frame was patented. And in 1843, the first full iron frame for a grand piano was patented. So we're really starting to get somewhere now. In the early days, pianos were incredibly expensive, so they were only used by the aristocracy and the very wealthy. And as we get into the 1800s, the middle class is getting more and more affluent. Pianos are getting easier to build, and more people have them in their homes. I was reading that it was more common for girls to play than boys. Now, this is not exactly PC, but was felt that if a woman played piano, she was more marriageable. The women played as children, came up, had their own families. We have a piano at home. We have music in the home. This was a real revolution at the time. Through the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, we have pianos all through Europe, more and more in the homes. We're starting to see them in public institutions, schools, hotels, public houses, this kind of thing. So there's more and more sheet music available. Prior to recordings, the big deal was to write a song, make sheet music, and sell the sheet music. The piano's going great guns all through North America. Everything's going good. Then we have, around 1900, the player piano comes in. You get the same great sound. You don't have to touch the keyboard. You buy these rolls, put them in, just plays. Away you go. You're good to go. You didn't have to learn anything. No 10,000 hours, none of that stuff. So this really took over, actually. A lot of piano sales dropped. A lot of piano manufacturers went out of business in this period, just kind of early turn of the century. The home phonograph came in the 1930s. That deteriorated a bit more. Then radio, from the 20s on, amateur piano playing is kind of slowing down more and more. So we get into recorded music, and that's where I'm leading with this. Jazz piano is really a collective term for the techniques pianists use when they're playing jazz. It's really an integral part of any jazz combo. There's a lot of instruments in jazz that can't play chords. They can only play single notes. So you need some chording instruments in the group, guitar, piano. So that was a really big thing to get the piano in the group. As you listen to jazz, you can kind of tell the era. You can kind of tell the evolution of the music by what the piano player is doing, what kind of harmonies he's using, what kind of rhythmic variation. It really defines the era. And I'd like to start off with a track from Jelly Roll Morton. So, Jim, if you can play the first track, please. This is a tune called The Pearls by Jelly Roll Morton. Driving rhythm, it's a lot of ornamentation in the left hand. This is definitely music from New Orleans. Jelly Roll lived between 1885 and 1940. He came from a pretty sophisticated Creole family, so he had to lie to his parents about what he was doing at night because he was playing in brothels and learning all this music and creating a lot of music. He was not a shy man. He walked around with flashy clothing and he had a diamond in his front tooth. He claimed to be the originator of jazz. Many people have called that into question, but he was a very, very important composer and certainly one of the originators of this style of music. Jelly Roll had early success in the 1920s, and then things kind of wound down for him. He fell on hard times. He moved around the country, moved to New York in the 30s, but he had little success. He had a hard time to find sidemen who could keep up to him, and his music was now starting to be considered old-fashioned. So it's really unfortunate because right at the end of his life, there was a real resurgence in this early New Orleans jazz, and had his health been better, he might have been able to ride this second wave. That really happened about the time he was quite sick and passed away in 1940. Next, I'd like to talk about one of his successors, I should say, Fats Waller, Thomas Fats Waller. His dates are 1914 to 1943. He is well known to everybody, I'm sure. This first piece I'd like to play is called A Handful of Keys. It's recorded in 1929, and it's from a Broadway review called Ain't Misbehavin', which is another famous Fats Waller song. So if we can play a bit of that, please, Jim. Jim, so you just hear the joy in his music. He was a really fun guy. I'm sure you've seen pictures of him, big grin always. His singing was kind of considered a novelty, but his jazz chops always shone through every piece he did. He created a lot of work that remains popular today. In 1934, he formed his own six-piece group, and for Victor, they recorded a bunch of sides, including Your Feet's Too Big. The whole title of that is, I love you, Mama, but your feet's too big. So you kind of get the idea where Fats is coming from. He's just a lot of fun. This Joint is Jumpin' was another one of his big hits. I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter was another one he did in this mid-30s period. He continued to work through the 40s with movie appearances. He did radio broadcasts and worked on many musicals. He was one of the first jazz guys to work with a pipe organ, play some jazz on a pipe organ and a Hammond organ. I think he was the first one to approach these instruments from a jazz point of view. In the 1940s, he toured throughout the country. He appeared in all kinds of musicals and movies, including a really famous one called Stormy Weather. I think that was from 1941. I could be a bit wrong on the date. Early 40s, anyway. The only problem with Fats is he really enjoyed to eat way too much and drink way too much, and eventually this caught up with him. He died of pneumonia on the Santa Fe Chief as he was coming home from Los Angeles back to New York in 1943. I think he'll live on forever for his, as I keep saying, joyous, joyous compositions. He's a larger-than-life fellow and just always seemed to have so much fun playing. He used to have all kinds of tricks where he'd bend over the piano and play it from the back. So he's, you know, everything's backwards to him, and he could just rip these incredible lines even with that kind of technique. Speaking of technique, the next guy I'd like to talk about is Art Tatum. He's a masterful musician, a pianist. His dates are 1910 to 1956. And I'd just like to play this example of his virtuosity. This is called Over the Rainbow. I'm sure you're all familiar with this from The Wizard of Oz. ¶¶ just a brief sample of Art Tatum's amazing virtuosity. There were many people in blindfold tests and would just hear his music without seeing him perform. They thought it was two or perhaps even three pianists playing at once. A young guy called Oscar Peterson was very influenced by Art Tatum. I'm not sure that he ever accomplished the technical mastery that Art Tatum had, but he certainly came close. In 1933, Art recorded a version of Tiger Rag. The virtuosity involved in that still scares jazz pianists to this very day, and that's from 1933. It's pretty remarkable, really, considering that he had a few lessons, but he was basically self-taught on piano, something else I just marvel at, you know. Classical pianist Vladimir Horowitz once stated that he was jealous of Art's playing ability. Mr. Horowitz was no slouch, so he understood what went into that kind of playing and what amazing reactions Art had. He could just cut on a dime, and he was so far ahead of his time, I think that didn't help his career, really. People were not really able to hear what he was doing quite yet. He was probably 30 years ahead of himself, certainly with the harmonies that he was trying to introduce. And his just lightning-fast reflexes were just something to behold. I think any jazz piano player has to really listen to some Tatum to understand where it can go, you know, how far advanced that physical technique can go. Next up is a real favorite of mine. This is a jazz pianist called Thelonious Monk. Thelonious Sphere Monk, I should give his full name, because it's so bizarre. His dates are 1917, and he passed in 1982. So now we're getting into the modern jazz era. This particular tune I'd like to play a sample of is called Round Midnight. This is the most recorded jazz standard of any piece composed by a jazz musician, probably in the history of the music. So if we could just have a bit of Round Midnight, please, Jim. As you can hear, as Mr. Dillon said, the times are changing. You know, Monk played a lot of things that were considered very dissonant in his day. Now they are so common, it's just incredible. In fact, you're really hard-pressed to see any jazz group perform at least, usually there'll be one Monk tune in every set, which is quite an accomplishment, really. Even in his time, he was not accepted. There were certain people that championed his music, and these included tenor great Coleman Hawkins, the great drummer Art Blakey, and, of course, trumpet player Miles Davis were some of his earlier champions. Monk didn't have a cabaret card in New York for various reasons, so he wasn't able to record early in his career. So these guys kind of took up his music. I know that Miles recorded Round Midnight and a Straight No Chaser and several others on his first. Round Midnight was the first album he did for Columbia back in the early 50s. So that helped his career a lot. Even though Monk started recording in 1947, it didn't gain popular acceptance till probably about 1957. During that summer, he had a very prestigious gig at the Fives Club in New York. And one of his side men was a young guy coming up, a saxophone player that we were to hear a lot about later, called John Coltrane. John Coltrane was really brought along by Thelonious Monk. He gave him a lot of tips. John had played with Miles before, but Miles really didn't talk about music. He talked about all kinds of other stuff. Monk actually gave him some fundamentals of his own tunes and of jazz in general, and that Coltrane was just off and running with that kind of tutelage. Monk's compositional style was set very early on, probably by 1947 when he started recording. He felt that he had achieved what he wanted to achieve, so virtually the rest of his career, and he recorded into the late 60s, till 1968, he really didn't change his style. He pretty much stuck with what he had accomplished in the very early days, which is pretty remarkable. He was just so sure of himself. He kept adding songs, but always in that same kind of area, a lot of dissonance. A lot of his songs, he learned from stride players in New York, which was really popular in the early 20th century. And the cadence of the stride music is really what Monk used. It's kind of a medium swing tempo, I guess you'd say. So he used that through the rest of his career. That particular track now became a two CD set. It started off as an LP, but it's just called Monk Alone, and it's two CDs of wonderful solo piano by Thelonious Monk. If people don't have that, I would recommend it highly. He uses a lot of old chestnuts and some of his own compositions, but always with his unique take. I think you hear one chorus, even a couple of bars, and you know it's Thelonious Monk. He had a very bizarre playing style. It was certainly not a classical technique where your arms are at parallel to the floor and your fingers are curved. He had really flat kind of percussive style, which was really bizarre looking, but it certainly got the desired effect. And when Monk would really be swinging and things are really cooking, if the band was grooving, he'd just get up from the piano and start dancing around, and everybody is really confused what was happening. I've come to find out that that's the band was cooking. That's all. So he figured, I can just dance now because I feel like it. You know, the rhythm's going, everything's happening. So he'd just get up and run around. It was really quite comical. I've just seen footage, of course, but he also had this thing where he'd shuffle his feet beside the piano that's, I guess, kind of counting in a way, but it was just his joy of the music that they were creating. And now I'd like to move to the more modern time. This is the last example I have of piano jazz is by the great Bill Evans. He was around between 1929 and 1980. This track is a beautiful ballad written by Victor Young. Actually, the music was written by a committee, Victor Young, Egbert Van Alstyne, and Wayne King, with lyrics by Haven Gillespie. This was recorded in 1961 by Bill Evans Trio. It's Beautiful Love. Thank you. So this was from a Bill Evans Trio record called Explorations. As I said, it was recorded in 1961, and that was his famous trio with Paul Modian on the drums and Scott LaFaro on bass. Bill Evans was, as they say in every book you read, he was introverted, but he had a real relaxed lyrical sensibility to his music. They say that he borrowed heavy from the Impressionist classical composers like Ravel and Debussy. I can certainly hear that in some of his playing. He always stressed that pianists should have a thorough knowledge of technique and harmony, and then they are free to play what inspiration comes to them. They don't have to worry about that part anymore, so it's exactly the path he followed. He studied theory at Southeastern Louisiana as a young man. He actually attended on a flute scholarship. I've never heard him play flute in my life, so perhaps he just put that aside once the piano became more a part of his life. I've read a bit about him as well, and it's really remarkable. He worked really, really hard at his touch on the piano. So he had a particular feel for the piano. I read about this party that he attended one time in New York. Everybody that was there was a pianist pretty well. Of course, it was a big fancy apartment. They had a grand piano in the apartment. They were playing some four hands and solo pieces. People just marveled that Bill could get a different sound than any other player in that room just because he had worked so hard on this touch to get the exact clarity of the note he wanted. I just think that's remarkable. I mean, for a non-player, you think you just push it down and that's done, but apparently not. Bill was a master at that. He also really changed the whole notion of a jazz trio. Basically, it was the piano player taking the lead, taking the main improvisations, the main solos, certainly the melody. And the bass and drums were more or less accompanists. And Bill thought, that's all good, but he wanted to bring more of a democratic situation to the trio. So he had all kinds of involvement from the bass player and the drummer. They were soloists as well. So they just changed the whole way that the music was approached. Each player could take solos and could add to the harmonic and rhythmic interest of the music. This was a real breakthrough, and many, many trios, so many come to mind. Keith Jarrett and many others in the modern era have picked up on this notion, and it just raised the bar for jazz piano playing and for trio performances as well. That's about it. I hope you enjoyed the brief history. I know that the music is short, but go out and find these people. There's lots of recordings, and as I say, I'm just into the 60s. There's way more to come after that, but I just thought it would be appropriate to introduce a bit of history of jazz piano. So thanks very much.
As Steve mentioned, there are huge discographies of piano jazz music available. While we've made a start with the important developments from these artists, we invite you to continue your search to find the styles or players that fire your imagination. In this area of jazz, there truly is music for all tastes and moods. We recorded the live presentation in October 2010. This program was made possible by Jazz Yukon, a volunteer organization that promotes and presents jazz in the Yukon through an annual integrated program of live jazz presentations and jazz education outreach. This episode was researched, written, and presented by Steve Gedrose, live recording by Jim Holland, script edits by David Sillery, Dieter Gade is our producer, and I am Maria Leniak. Thank you for listening.